Support for IPR comes from Orchestra Iowa, presenting the movie E.T., the extraterrestrial on the big screen, accompanied by the Symphony Orchestra performing the score live, May 3rd and 4th at 7:30 at the Paramount. Tickets at orchestraiowa.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from IPR News. I'm Charity Nebbe. Later this hour, we'll meet Christine Herr, Executive Director of ArtForce Iowa. But first, diabetes and COVID-19. According to the CDC, one out of every 10 Americans has diabetes. One out of three has pre-diabetes. And the COVID-19 pandemic has interacted with diabetes in dangerous and complicated ways. To help us understand the relationship between COVID-19 and diabetes, Dr. Martha Carvor is here. She's an assistant professor of internal medicine and infectious diseases at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Dr. Carvor, thank you so much for being here. And I want to ask you first to help us define a few things, because I think when we talk about diabetes, it's important to understand the difference between type 1 diabetes and type 2 diabetes. We throw this term around all the time. So first, let's just start with that distinction, the difference between type 1 and type 2.
Sure. Yeah. Happy to talk about this topic. I think that the one of the key things to remember is that type 2 diabetes is by far the most common, and it's certainly the most common in adults and one of the things that's more likely to be diagnosed later in life. Type 2 diabetes is something that we can often treat with a variety of different types of medication. So in some cases, there are more options for treatments available for type 2 diabetes. Type 1 diabetes can certainly also happen. It's less common. It is one that you may more often see in younger patients or even in children. But the reality is that there's a fair amount of overlap kind of between these two and in some ways with some of the medications that we can try to use for treating them.
All right. And so type 1 diabetes is something that people develop that they don't have control over whether or not they develop. Type 2 diabetes, there can be lifestyle controls for that.
There can certainly be more factors in type 2 mm-hmm. diabetes that are related to food, to exercise, to some of the other types of factors. In healthcare and in public health, we sometimes refer to these as social determinants of health. So things in everyday life that sort of impact the health and the conditions that happen. And that's important for type 2 diabetes because we know that sometimes helping patients to think about those other things or to accommodate some of those things a little bit differently can help to control some of the diabetes with maybe less reliance on medication.
Let's talk about pre-diabetes, because this is also something that we'll be talking about. What does it mean? And as I mentioned, one out of three Americans has pre-diabetes. What does that mean?
Yeah, that's a great question. So prediabetes is something that is, as the name kind of suggests, it's sort of on the path towards having a full diagnosis of diabetes. Usually when we think about diabetes, we're thinking about levels of blood sugar in the body. And so prediabetes is where those levels are rising, but not quite yet across the line that we would think of for diagnosing diabetes. But that's an important range. If someone has prediabetes or we see that that's starting to happen, it's often a great time to be able to intervene and to try to prevent or at least slow the onset of diabetes and then maybe hopefully prevent some of the complications of diabetes down the road.
And just last year, we celebrated the 100th anniversary of the discovery of insulin, which, of course, has saved so many lives for people with diabetes. And that's really the key to understanding diabetes, right, is insulin and what it does in our body.
Insulin is important for a number of patients with diabetes in terms of treatment. We do have some other medications that help to use to sort of make the body work better with the insulin that it might have if the body does make insulin. So it is absolutely a critical part of understanding why diabetes happens and often in ways that we treat or approach diabetes care.
Now, I want to start with the vulnerability of people who have diabetes to COVID-19. Early on in the pandemic, that was something that we heard a lot about, that people with diabetes were particularly vulnerable to severe cases or even death with COVID-19. So now, as things have developed over the last 2 years, what have we learned about that?
Yeah, so that is definitely one of the things that we saw very early on in the pandemic, just as you said, that patients who had diabetes before the pandemic started were more likely to have really serious problems with the infection. So more likely to have serious complications, more likely to need to stay in a hospital, and really more likely, unfortunately, to die from COVID. And we found that actually a huge number of the patients who died in those first phases of the pandemic, particularly before the vaccine became available. Unfortunately, this was a disproportionate burden on patients with diabetes. So we've seen that pretty consistently. And so that's something that we've been concerned about in terms of preventing COVID, both with personal protective equipment and then certainly with vaccine use also.
And once the vaccines became available, do we still see, of course, you know, right now, as we see the vaccine protection waning over time, we are seeing more older Americans again having severe cases of COVID-19. With people with diabetes, is that something that we're seeing? You know, if they got vaccinated, how protected are they?
Yeah, so the vaccine definitely still will give a huge protective effect. Even if you get vaccinated and end up getting the infection, the likelihood that you'll get really, really sick with the infection is lower. So that vaccine does help to protect at least from more severe disease. Diabetes is something that has a lot of impacts on a lot of different organ systems and processes in the body. And one of those is really being able to respond to infection. And so I would generally say that with any type of infection, including COVID, it's still possible for patients with diabetes to maybe have a more severe case. But that's exactly why we recommend to our patients who have diabetes to really get that vaccine and do the best that science has to offer,
right,
to prevent that infection from getting to that severe case.
So it's very important for all of us to get vaccinated, but for people with diabetes in particular, that's
very
a very important step to take. So one of the strange things, at least from my perspective, it seemed to be odd, and I can't wait to hear your thoughts on it, that we started seeing as people were infected with COVID-19, survived COVID-19, we saw an increase in the number of those patients getting diagnosed with diabetes.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me what we've observed.
Yeah, this has been a really important finding that's been coming out now in a few different studies from a number of different groups and scientists that have shown that both adults and children do have a higher risk of new diabetes even after having COVID. So this is a different group of patients than what we were just talking about, as you said. So patients who didn't have diabetes going into the whole pandemic period may be more likely to have diabetes now. I think there are probably a couple of things that are happening. So one of these is simply that there may have been delays in getting diagnosis for diabetes during the last couple of years. So patients who may have been sort of crossing that line we talked about between pre-diabetes and diabetes during that pandemic phase, when it was just harder in many ways to get into care, to mm-hmm. get screened, to get diagnosed and treated. And so some of these may be sort of delayed diagnoses that were happening over that period of time that we're picking up or starting to pick up now. And some of these could also be related, reaching back to the comment I made earlier about social determinants of health. So the pandemic has disrupted everything, and it's certainly disrupted, you know, my ability to be physically active in ways that were the usual for me, to eat sort of the usual foods or get access to nutritional foods. It's had huge impacts on people's ability to work or the way that we work. So all of those things also have an impact on health, and all of those things can also have an impact on some of those kinds of medical conditions like diabetes. So another possibility is that it's some of those things that have also been piling up over the last few years, and we're now seeing maybe more cases that are developing as a result of that. And then the third possibility, which I think is something we're all concerned about, is a more direct relationship between the disease or the virus itself and diabetes. And there is at least some emerging evidence to suggest that. So I think we're seeing higher rates than we would expect just from those other factors that are sort of the pandemic by itself, the factors that are not the result of the infection itself. So we do think that there's a higher risk in both adults and children from having had COVID itself, that it may be somehow leading to or triggering or accelerating the process of developing diabetes in a number of patients. And so we're seeing that pretty consistently now in a number of studies coming out.
And there are so many questions about this, and I understand that it's difficult to untangle all of these threads. We'll be untangling these threads for years to try to understand this relationship. When we talk about an increase in cases of diabetes being diagnosed post-COVID-19, are we seeing an increase in both type 1 diabetes and type 2 diabetes?
Yeah, I think we're probably seeing an increase in those that look at least clinically look like the different types. And that probably follows with those sort of three different possibilities that I mentioned. You're absolutely right that this is sort of a complicated group of factors, and it's going to take a while to sort of sort out exactly what's happening and exactly how to think about, you know, preventing one thing leading to the next, which of course would be one of the things we'd hope to be able to know how to do scientifically. A bright side here is that unlike when COVID first started, where we really didn't have a lot of information about how to treat or prevent COVID, we do have a lot of information about how to treat diabetes and prevent complications. So even if we don't yet know exactly what causes that connection between the two, we can certainly still have patients diagnosed and treated, and we can hopefully be preventing those complications over the long term, even as the science takes a while to catch up.
And with diabetes treatment, it is not like a simple fix, but there are very, very solid treatments for diabetes. Many people with diabetes live full, active lives, although they do need to care for themselves in really specific ways every day.
Yes, yes, absolutely. We have a long period of time with a lot of existing research going back many, many years about how to treat diabetes, how to ensure that patients with diabetes can do what they want to do and need to do on a daily basis. And so that's something that's encouraging to me, that we're not sort of having to catch up in that part. We can actually work and treat patients right away and not have to sort out those other details.
We are going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I am talking with Dr. Martha Carvor. She's an assistant professor of internal medicine and infectious diseases at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. We're talking about diabetes and COVID-19. This is Talk of Iowa.
Support for IPR comes from Orchestra Iowa, presenting the movie E.T., the extraterrestrial on the big screen, accompanied by the Symphony Orchestra performing the score live, May 3rd and 4th at 7:30 at the Paramount. Tickets at orchestraiowa.com.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
It's Talk of Iowa from IPR News. I'm Charity Nebbe. Coming up in about 15 minutes, we'll meet Christine Herr, Executive Director of Art Force Iowa. Right now, we are talking about diabetes and COVID-19. We knew early on in the pandemic that people with diabetes were vulnerable to COVID-19. Of course, vaccines have made people much more resilient in the face of this virus. We also have learned a lot of other things about diabetes and COVID-19 over the past 2 years. And to help us understand the relationship, Dr. Martha Carvor is here. She is an assistant professor of internal medicine and infectious diseases at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. If you have questions, you're welcome to call. You can give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Dr. Carvor, just before the break, we were talking about the fact that we've seen an increase in people getting diagnosed with diabetes after surviving COVID-19. Now, I think we need to make it clear that this is not this is not a, we're not seeing something that leads us to say COVID-19 causes diabetes, but there is a relationship and an emerging relationship between the two, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we don't know for sure exactly what's happening. So I would agree with probably being a little bit cautious about saying with confidence that mm-hmm. we know exactly what's happening or exactly how, you know, a virus might be leading to something else. So we don't know exactly what that is, if it could be the virus, if it could be something happening with the immune system, you know, it could be something else. But there definitely does seem to be some sort of relationship or association where we know that that risk is appears to be higher, and that that's something that for right now is important just to think about. Getting screened for diabetes and getting into treatment if it's there. And you're right, we are seeing some of these diabetes diagnoses rising. I do anticipate that we will continue to see that rise for a while, and that's probably because we are in a catch-up period. And I think it's really important to diagnose the diabetes that's there, even if we see those rates rise a bit, because we'd rather diagnose it early and get patients connected to care so that we can help to prevent long-term complications, things like heart disease, stroke, kidney problems, and many of the other infections.
Right. Blindness, yeah. And there are all kinds of cascading yep. problems that can develop. And is that something that doctors need to be thinking hard about as they see patients, sometimes returning for that annual physical for the first time in a few years, looking for these symptoms as we're seeing arise?
Yes, I definitely think that that's true. And I think it's probably worth thinking about this even in patients where it may not be always top of mind, right? Mm-hmm. So because we know that there may be an unusual relationship here with COVID, and virtually everyone has been exposed to COVID. Not everyone has had COVID, but we know that it's such a far-reaching type of exposure, and that so many people have had the infection, unfortunately, that it's probably worth, you know, thinking about that as a part of the screening process and primary care for all of our patients. I would note that we know that there are many patients who don't really have ready access to physicians or to other healthcare providers who can help to screen or to diagnose, or may not have access quickly to be able to get into that sort of care. And in many cases, it may also be related to some of those other factors, right? And work schedules and everything else that's been so disrupted, it may be really hard. So this is something where I'm working also on the sort of public health side and working with communities to say, how can we get testing to people? You know, how can we make this more readily available and then connect people to care in a way that works better for them so that we don't rely exclusively on sort of getting into clinics and resources that may be still relatively scarce or still having to spend a good deal of time on COVID, right, mm-hmm. on treating COVID initially.
Well, and of course, there are many people dealing with long COVID, dealing with baffling symptoms, difficult symptoms. What are some of the symptoms that should lead a person to say, I need to be tested to see if I'm having, if I'm developing diabetes?
Yeah, so you're absolutely right. So I have begun to think of diabetes as maybe being a part of the sort of long COVID set of symptoms. And long COVID is another condition that we don't fully understand, but we do know that patients, after they have recovered from that initial period, that initial infection with COVID, that they do go on to develop a number of different types of symptoms. And those can be everything from shortness of breath to dizziness to pain. We really are seeing a number of different concerns. Patients who report that it's just kind of harder to think or to do things quite normally. So those are very real syndromes that we're seeing in a large number of patients. We don't know for sure exactly what the relationship is with those two things, but since there's obviously COVID and long COVID have a relationship, and diabetes is perhaps something that's also a long-term result of COVID, I think it's worth thinking about screening for diabetes in patients who are having long COVID. That's sort of a personal opinion. It's something I would want done for myself, at least if I were experiencing long COVID symptoms. Patients who are noticing other complications that they're concerned about. So vision changes, if you're noticing, you know, you have changes in your foot, you're not as able to feel your foot, or you have, an actual wound developing on your foot, you're maybe just tired or having more pain, aches and pains that you can't quite explain. Some of those things that I'm mentioning are more like complications of diabetes after it's been there for a while. So certainly if you're noticing any of those things, you'd want to get screened. But that doesn't mean that we should wait until those things happen to get screened, because hopefully we can treat diabetes earlier and prevent some of those types of symptoms or noticeable difficulties.
If you have a question, you're welcome to join our conversation, 866-780-9100. And Mark is on the line in Council Bluffs. Hello, Mark.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
Well, I was diagnosed with diabetes about a year ago, February. And since then, I've been double vaccinated, now double boosted. And I just wonder, you know, how vigilant should I be? I've been one of those odd people wearing a mask where nobody else is, like in a setting of a conference of 200 to 300 people. And just kind of wonder how vigilant I should be with my mask wearing, being a recent diabetic diagnosis, doing really well, but just wondering how vigilant I should be in the pandemic.
Yeah, thank you for that question. That's a great question. I think it's probably on a lot of people's minds, so I thank you for raising that. First, it's great to hear that you've gotten connected to care, and you're on the right track there for sure. I definitely agree with this sort of idea of even if we can't perfectly reduce our risk, we can at least do some things that fit into everyday life to try to reduce that risk. I think that it still makes sense to think about certainly things like hand sanitizer, mask use. If you feel comfortable wearing a mask, I still am wearing my mask right now in sort of any crowded space, especially right now as we're seeing some of these rates of COVID be a little bit higher. That may fluctuate a bit because we may see the virus rates come and go for a period of time. And so I think certainly if you're noticing that that's happening at a higher rate, certainly it makes sense to think of that as the time where you may have more protection from doing some of those things. A related note is also thinking about just, you know, protecting from other types of viruses that are now, you know, also circulating and just other respiratory viruses that can cause like cold and flu symptoms. And that's one of the other benefits of some of those very same types of things that we recommend to prevent COVID. So it can help to keep you healthy in a number of different ways. But it definitely sounds like, you know, one of the most important things that you're doing is just really, already getting connected to care and taking care of the diabetes itself.
And getting vaccinated and boosted. Talking about masking in a crowd that large, I mean, that seems like one of those situations where even if you're not masking in other situations, that sounds like exactly the right time to wear a mask, doesn't it?
Yes, and it will offer some protection. That's definitely not perfect, as we all unfortunately are aware. But I think that that you are doing what you can do. And so I think that increasingly, as the weather also, I'm happy to see, is improving, we'll hopefully have more opportunities to attend things that are actually outdoors or where we have a little bit more space. And so I'm hoping that will help to be protective too.
Mark, thank you so much for your call and take care. I'm talking with Dr. Martha Carvor. She is an assistant professor of internal medicine and infectious diseases at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. We're talking about COVID-19 and diabetes. And now I want to talk about pre-diabetes. There was a stunning paper published in JAMA Pediatrics recently. And the finding was that type 2 diabetes people who are pre-diabetic on the cusp of developing type 2 diabetes include 28% of young people between the ages of 12 to 19 in the United States. 28%. I found that incredibly shocking. And that's a number that has risen dramatically. When you see that number, what is your reaction?
Yeah, I definitely think it's something that's concerning. One of the other things that can stand out about a number like that is it's better to know the number than to not know, right? So I think better to know if we have patients, including kids. I don't see children in my own practice. I'm not in pediatric care, but I some of these principles are very similar, mm-hmm. right? So I think it's better to know and to pick up on those things early and be able to either prevent the onset of diabetes or to treat diabetes if it does in fact develop. I suspect that a big part of what is driving that number, much like what happens across the age or lifespan, is again getting back to some of those social determinants of health. And so making sure that our kids are healthy in a number, sort of well-rounded number of ways. So some of that may be reflecting nutrition, ability to engage in physical activity and exercise. Some of it may actually be stress. Our kids have been under profound amounts of stress, especially over the last few years, in ways that I think it's hard to fully appreciate. So I think a lot of other things that are also, you know, kind of contributing to some of these factors in probably both in adults and children.
So when somebody is diagnosed as being pre-diabetic, tell me again exactly what that means.
Yeah, so it essentially means that when we think about diabetes in the simplest sense in terms of blood sugar, right? Blood sugar that's higher than it should be. What we think of there being a line that you cross when you when we diagnose you as having diabetes, and then there's a line below which is sort of normal, or it's within a range that we normally think of as healthy and normal, and then there's sort of a middle section in between those two lines where it's higher, the blood sugar is higher than we would usually see in healthy patients overall who don't go on to get diabetes, and then it's lower than what we see in diabetes. And we know that that's an important range because what we're essentially seeing is a trend in the blood sugar that we can address early on and perhaps even prevent the onset or slow the onset of diabetes by acting sooner. And so that's one of the huge benefits of being able to think about that, you know,
right.
That
so it's a red flag.
Mm-hmm.
And when that red flag is thrown, let's say I'm diagnosed with prediabetes, what do I do? Because I can change parts of my lifestyle to hopefully avoid developing full-blown diabetes, right?
Yes. So there are definitely some things that you can do. So some of those things are the things that we talk about all the time. Easier said than done, especially right now, especially when we have limited access we have supply chain issues and we have expensive food and so many other things happening with the other factors that the pandemic also brought on, right? So that not just the effects of the virus itself, but all of the other disruptions in our access to food, to healthy and nutritious food, to being able to engage in normal physical activity, being able to sort of just to physically exercise or even get out and walk and do some of those sorts of things. It's harder, certainly in some ways, but those are some of the things that are good overall for health and can also be helpful for this. If someone has been diagnosed as having prediabetes, that's also a good occasion to talk specifically with their own health provider, whoever that might be, because there may be some other recommendations that are more specific to the individual that can help.
Cutting out sugary drinks and things like that can be very fundamental, right?
Right. Yeah. And I think that can be really helpful. Or talking with someone who's an expert in nutrition or really getting something that's more, you know, customized to mm-hmm. to you as an individual. As I'm talking right now, it's very big picture, sort of broad strokes. And that's not always helpful, especially when we've got other, you know, really high priorities every single day that we know we have to focus on and things we have to check off of our task list. So sometimes those big recommendations are harder to follow than really sitting down with someone and saying, here's one thing I can focus on and I can do that. Here's one thing I can focus on and I'll do that next.
So as we've been talking about, you know, there are threads that we need to unravel to understand the relationship between COVID-19 and diabetes, the relationship between the pandemic and diabetes and pre-diabetes and all of that. And we're going to keep working to understand that. But I also hear you saying that the best thing right now is to raise awareness so people know what to look for. I mean, as you're looking at these numbers rising, what do you think our number one priorities are?
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. So we are going to, it's going to take some time to sort of unravel, as you said, sort out exactly what the relationships are and how exactly, you know, can we tell exactly which groups of patients are most likely to have this experience with diabetes after COVID. We do want to raise awareness. We do want to think about screening and getting into care if someone does have diabetes. I think one of the things that we should also think about is really ensuring that access to screening and access to care is also improved. And the ways that we sort of think about this more broadly, this is also something that we're working on at the university. My colleagues and I know are all really focused on and committed to this idea. We know that a lot of things have been disrupted in just being able to get into a clinic, for example, is really hard. You know, people may have a work schedule or they may be harder to travel to a clinic. So making more of those things available to people where they are is also a priority of ours. And I think something we need to make sure, we can't just tell people to get a screening and treatment that they can't access.
Right. We need to make it possible. Dr. Carvor, thank you so much for your time and your expertise today.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Dr. Martha Carvor, she is an assistant professor of internal medicine and infectious diseases at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. We have been talking about the relationship between diabetes and COVID-19. Coming up in just a moment, we will meet Christine Herr. She is executive director of ArtForce Iowa. This is Talk of Iowa.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
It's Talk of Iowa from IPR News. I'm Charity Nebbe. Now we are going to meet an Iowan who has been making a difference in the lives of young people in Des Moines for years, particularly young people who come from families of refugees, immigrants, or are first-generation Americans. Christine Herr is the executive director of ArtForce Iowa. She knows firsthand what it's like to build a life in a culture that is new to your family, in an environment where you're seen as an outsider. She was born in Des Moines, but her parents were refugees from Laos. She is a proud member of Iowa's Hmong community, and she is with me now. Hello, Christine.
Hi, I'm so happy to be here.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And of course, this is Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month. We're going to talk more about that on tomorrow's Talk of Iowa. But you are part of a community that is often overlooked. Can you tell me what that was like for you growing up?
Yeah, of course. You know, I think growing up for me and being part of the Hmong community, it felt like I was invisible. I didn't feel invisible when I went to church or when I was with my family, but definitely out in the community and in the classroom. Oftentimes, you know, when I shared that I was Hmong, people would say, "Oh, so you're Mongolian." And I would have to say, "Well, no, I'm Hmong, that's different." And the first thing is always, "Well, what country are you from then?" And then I'd have to explain to people we didn't have our own country. So then it really felt even more devastating growing up and being part of this community that doesn't have their own country, but also a community that isn't taught in the classroom of who we are and why we're here. So I felt invisible growing up.
And what brought your parents to Des Moines?
Well, my dad, he actually had a sister who was living in Des Moines. And so when he was able to come from the refugee camps in Thailand, he came straight to Des Moines because he had family here. And my understanding is that when they were making their documents to come here, we had a lot of church families in Iowa that were sponsoring refugees from Southeast Asia.
And when you were growing up and learning American history, you talked about feeling invisible, but your father in particular, his personal history with American troops during the Vietnam War, you felt like that was part of American history that was just ignored or glossed over in your history classes or any classes. Tell me a little bit more about his background and that relationship.
Absolutely. So, you know, I grew up just kind of like, okay, I'm an American kid. And that's a term that my parents had always used. You're an American kid, but you're also Hmong. So don't forget that. And growing up, I would hear stories of how my grandpa on my dad's side, he was an army recruiter for the U.S. and he was actually recruiting, you know, Hmong foot soldiers to support America. I have an uncle who was one of the fighter jets pilots for the Vietnam War as well. And every time we would go up to Minnesota, these are the stories that I would hear, you know, how he was able to, you know, fly this army pilot and, you know, save so many Americans. And my dad eventually would tell us as we got older, bits and pieces of his journey story coming to America and how he was a teenage soldier and how he had to live in the jungles for a couple of years and how he came to America by leaving his dad behind in the jungles with the promise that he would come back for him. And so for me, I remember thinking when I was in high school, we're covering the Vietnam War. Oh my gosh, people are going to finally know who we are because we're in America, because Hmong people fought that war with Americans. And people are going to finally know who we are because they have to cover us because we were part of this war. Yeah. And we covered it in a day or two. And I just remember thinking, oh, they aren't going to teach about who we are. We're going to continue to be invisible and people are going to continue to not know what we did for this country because we're Americans too, you know? And I remember just thinking it wasn't just me. It was a lot of us who were Southeast Asians at that time, thanks to, you know, former Governor Bob Rae, who said, I want refugees to be able to make Iowa home. It was all of us who were first generation Americans going to school at the same time, recognizing that our stories and our histories were being left behind. And that felt not good growing up and trying to find out what your identity is and who you are and who you're supposed to be and where you're supposed to go. And if you don't know, and if people don't know and can't acknowledge where you have been or your history, it's really hard to navigate what that looks like for you as you navigate the world, right?
Right.
So it wasn't just Hmong kids like me. It was Laotian kids that were my friends. It was Thai Dam kids who were my friends. It was the Vietnamese who were my friends. So many of us who came here, whose parents made that difficult journey to have a better life. It was all of us first generation American kids who were like, what? What about us? So that was an interesting way to kind of grow up and have that community of other first-generation American kids, too.
Yes, and that connects directly to the work that you are doing with young people today in Des Moines with ArtForce. Tell me how you found ArtForce. What drew you to this organization?
Yeah, so I was working at the Des Moines Register at the time, and I had a really good friend named Molly. I love her. She was the program manager for the only program at ArtForce Iowa at the time. And she said, you know, Christine, you are a singer, songwriter, musician. We need more, you know, musicians to work with us at ArtForce. And honestly, to be fully transparent, we need more people of color artists. And so I was like, okay, well, this sounds really great because I've always wanted to start my own nonprofit that was arts-based, that was a space for young people of color, young people who are living in poverty. And so I said yes. And I kind of just, from there in 2015, it just became this huge love of mine because I love the arts. I love being able to work with young people. And I just think there's this magical, powerful thing that happens when people can come together and explore who they are, and they get to use art to explore that. So the rest was history after becoming an artist mentor in 2015.
Well, I don't know if it's history because you became the executive director, in 2017, and you have done so much to build this organization up and help people connect. For people who aren't familiar with ArtForce, tell us a little bit about your mission.
Absolutely. So for those of you who don't know us and those of you who do, we went through a whole new rebranding. So this year, we were able to launch our new logo and a whole new mission. And I'm just so proud to be able to let people know that our mission today is creating opportunities for youth to transform through art. And it was really important for us to make this change so that people can honor and celebrate the fact that young people are transforming their own lives, and we get to be a part of that. So that was a really critical moment for us to acknowledge and recognize that we're not doing the transformation. It's actually young people, and we're providing opportunities. So I love what we get to do, and we get to do that by creating these amazing opportunities for youth to explore and experiment and also show up as their true authentic selves.
And you are working with children who are from immigrant, refugee, or they're first generation Americans. You're also working with young people who have had involvement in the juvenile or family court system. So you are there for children and young people who are vulnerable in a number of different ways.
Absolutely. Yeah, you know, we're just really fortunate that we get to have a safe space and that young people actually want to come and hang out with us. One of the things that I love most about our community is that it is very family oriented. And that really came from a young person asking, a young refugee asking about his brother, who we were all really confused by. It's like, where's my brother? How come he's not in workshop today? And we just kept thinking, who's he talking about? Because we only enrolled him. And who he was referring to was a young person who was gang related. And he was like, well, that's my brother. And so after hearing that terminology being used by our young people, it's become this huge thing where ArtForce Iowa is a family. And regardless of where you come from and what you look like, we really want to support each other and let young people know, you know, this family is a family that you get to make up as well. So we're not blood family, but we're our chosen family.
And you have seen young people just connect in incredibly powerful ways. Tell me a little bit. I know that we could probably talk about this for hours, but give me an example of the kind of environment that you're able to create with ArtForce that has given young people a chance to connect in a way that you weren't expecting.
You know, with COVID and going virtual, it wasn't just me, it was our entire team. We were like, oh no, we're not going to have the same kinds of connections virtually. And when we were all together pre-pandemic, we would have conversations with our young people that were about everything, whether it was, you know, being on your period or sexual health or what they needed help with in school. And then seeing them kind of talk with each other and support each other, we were worried that we weren't going to be able to have those kinds of conversations virtually. And we had our couple of first virtual workshops back in 2020. And a young person said, you know, ArtForce Iowa really isn't a physical place. It's just where the people are. Wow. And that was a big moment for me to recognize that it isn't this physical space. We can still talk about all of these things virtually because the young people feel like they belong and they have safety and they know that even though we're not together in proximity, that we can still have hard conversations and we can still have funny conversations, and it still feels like we're together anyway. So that was a really big moment for us because it was such a huge change to go completely virtual. And we're still virtual today because COVID has really impacted our communities and we're trying to keep everyone safe. And that was, you know, one of those moments where we were able to look at ourselves and say, okay, we've created a safe space that no matter where we go, it's just where we are. It's just where the people are.
It just helps you. It almost helps you define yourselves further. Yeah, having to go through this. Before we run out of time, I also want to talk about one of your newer projects, the Legacy Collection. Tell me about this.
So the Legacy Collection really came about because so many of us were like, where is my history in the classroom? How come people don't know about me? And so we talked about this earlier where, you know, I grew up really sad and feeling invisible because my history wasn't being taught in the classroom when it was tied to American history as well. So the Legacy Collection launched last year in honor of every person who hasn't been able to share their story, who has shared their story and we haven't been listening. So this project is all about archiving and elevating the many voices that make up our state so that we can expand, you know, and reshape the dominant narratives that perpetuate racism and oppression. So for me, this whole collection is just letting Iowans tell their stories through their own words. And what's really cool is that we're working with academic scholars who can then create discussion guides or curricula from the stories. And we're working with artists in our community who can then either create documentaries or short stories or coloring books off of these stories. And one of my biggest hopes is that this collection will just allow all of us, every single person, regardless of what your skin color is, your gender identity, who you choose to love, what you believe in, that we can just humanize each other and really remind each other that we all want love and joy and kindness. So this project is going to gather and preserve and share collective history of Iowa through Iowan stories. And then, like I said, these stories will be captured in a variety of forms, like interviews, essays, songs, animations, journals. So that way, as a community, we can know who our neighbors are and not be fearful of who our neighbors are.
And your very first project as part of this Legacy Collection is very personal to you. You had the opportunity to tell your father's story and to help him tell his story.
Yeah, I mean, this is the first time I have heard him share his story in chronological order. And I believe this is the first time he shared this story in chronological order in 40 years.
Wow.
So it was a powerful moment to be able to sit with my dad and talk through, you know, what he went through and to show and let him hear his own resilience by sharing his story. But there's a lot of trauma and a lot of shame and a lot of guilt in surviving and not going back to get his dad who was in the jungles of Laos. And being able to do this project was special to me because after we got done filming, He looked at me and he said, you know, I feel so much better being able to share this because I was a kid. I was 16 when I had to make that decision. And I don't have to beat myself up anymore because I was just a kid. And maybe it's better to talk about it so I can let things go. And that was really special for me because I think a lot of times, you know, Asian elders don't feel like they can share their pain and let it go, or there's a stigma in being able to talk about those kinds of things. So it's a really special moment.
Yeah. And maybe they don't think anybody's interested in hearing, but that's not the case. Christine Herr, thank you so much for talking with me and sharing some of your extraordinary work today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Christine Herr is the executive director of Art Force Iowa. And if you go to the website, artforceiowa.org. You can learn all about the work that they're doing, but also if you click on the Legacy Collection, you can see that documentary created out of her father's story. It is called simply A Father's Story. My Dad Was a Teenage Soldier. This is Talk of Iowa from IPR News. I'm Charity Nebbe.